Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Sans Pants Radio, Australia's most five-thumbed podcast network.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bookish. I'm George DeMorelis. This is a show where we ask you what's your story and what does it say about you. Today on the show we have a comedian and radio host. You grew up here in Melbourne, but you've spent a lot of time in the UK. Johnny Katz, how you doing, Johnny?
Good, man. Thanks for having me, George.
No problem. Glad to have you on. How you feeling? What's up? What's been happening?
I'm feeling good, man. I mean, I just when you sent me the challenge of coming on and talking about one of my favorite books, yeah, it was nostalgic, so thank you for that, because I went back and dug up a book that I fell in love with years ago, which was like an introduction to me to physics and quantum physics and relativity, and by no stretch of the imagination, it was written for layman people like myself. So it was a wonderful journey to go over that book again, and I just, yeah, relive those moments why I fell in love with those topics.
Nice, yeah. Well, what your book for today is?
It's called The Fabric of the Cosmos, and it's written by someone called Brian Greene, who's a physicist as much as he is a wonderful, eloquent talker on physics, but dumbing it right down, removing the mathematics and making it easy to understand and making you fall in love. It's very difficult to not fall in love with what he has to say about the universe and in particular quantum physics and so forth.
Yeah, this is like, it's funny because it's such a different field, obviously, to right now what you do with comedy and stuff like that. It's just a passion, right?
Yeah, it's completely a hobby. It's completely a hobby. Like, I don't know, I would love to, I'm not going to say this, I will end up learning algebra when I get older in my retirement. Like, that will be, yeah, absolutely.
When you say algebra, isn't algebra like everything? Isn't algebra like 1 + 1? Does that count as algebra? No.
No, algebra is like 1 plus A equals 2A.
Okay. And then that's not what that is, but...
Yeah.
It's basically... Didn't you learn any of that stuff in school?
I did, and I did enjoy it, I must admit, but not to go over it too much, but basically algebra is one of the fundamental tools in the toolbox for a physicist and a mathematician to understand what's going on in the universe. Algebra transcends all these codes of architecture, biology, mathematics, physics, everything. So basically they're like, if you want to learn, this is from a podcast I listened to that said, if you want to learn physics and anything like that, get a good grounding in algebra. It all emanates, it's the root of all. It
right.
All stems from that.
But it's not, that's if you want to get like, I don't know. I think algebra like that sort of stuff, don't get me wrong, clearly hugely useful for people in the industry who want to be like, who are actually doing the actual like nuts and bolts stuff. But in terms of the story and knowing it all, I just don't think it's that as if it's that relevant then. You know what I mean?
Well, you get a deeper understanding. Like, for example, E equals MC squared, right?
Mm-hmm.
Energy and mass are the same thing. You can get energy and turn it into mass. And you can get mass and turn it into energy. But the C squared component, if you learn algebra, you can move that around to get energy on its own, to get mass on its own.
Yeah, I guess. But like, I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I have, this is actually reminding me of something I studied finance in university. So I know basics of finance and stuff and microeconomics and economics in general. So even with how markets work, because I worked in a bank, I know some of how that works in terms of like, shares and how they trade and the differences in how like different deltas and gammas and all that stuff, but not in extreme detail. And I'm not really like, I like finance for the story side, like as in the, it's interesting seeing how much of history is based on it and all that stuff. You know what I mean? So, and that side doesn't really need you to know how to do derivative trading to like ridiculous detail. You just got to kind of know what it is. You got to know what a gamma and alpha and blah, blah, blah is in terms of the market, but you don't need to know more than that. So that's why I'd see be like the same with like algebra and physics. I'd be like, yeah, you got to know what it is just so you kind of get it, but it's not really relevant unless you're in there, I don't know, in the coal face, like in the coal mine, right? Otherwise, yeah, I just like the story.
Yeah, absolutely. The story's fantastic. But if I could have a little bit of a better, deeper understanding of the algebra, I could combine the two, marry the two, and have a deeper understanding of it all. They say... physics, like Brian Greene said it himself. He goes, I can only take you so far. If you do have the time to actually learn the equations and manipulate them like a mechanic, move them from left to right, you actually understand on a deeper level
the fundamental nature of how it's all connected.
But like I said to you, you know, that's something in retirement because it's going to be a huge undertaking. Because, you know, I work, I've got a stand-up career. So it's very difficult. I finish work, I come home. I get ready for my gig. I go through my material. I've written a play, which I've talked to you about. I want to get that done. Algebra is something of, you know, something in the future. But it's great. I think it's not a bad thing. I think it's a beautiful thing because I'm always looking, oh, I'm going to do that one day. The same time when I was a kid, I watched Eddie Murphy Delirious, and I'm like, I'm going to fucking do that one day.
Yeah.
But not now because I'm in primary school.
You get in trouble for swearing like that and those kind of racial slurs. Well, that was back – that was the 90s, right? You could do that all day.
Well, yeah, I was a product of my environment. Back then, Eddie Murphy was king.
He was.
Delirious was like fucking king. I remember Delirious, the VHS tape, went in the machine and I was beside myself. I was too young to understand the content, but my brother, who was 7 years older and all his mates were older, they were just fucking glued and mesmerized. And I'm like, wow, look at that power.
Mm.
What is happening in this room right now? They're all fixated.
Oh, really?
And I fell in love with his mannerisms and his energy and his coolness. And I had no idea what the material was. So, yeah.
Yeah, the delivery. Yeah. Like his presence was what you were, like, loving.
In awe of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting because, like, from seeing you on stage, you're probably not quite – that's not the style of comedian you are, I would say.
Mm.
In a way. Not in a bad way. Everyone's different styles.
Everyone's different, yeah.
Was that a, I guess, I mean, everyone says you've got to be whatever you are. Did you fall into what you were, or did you kind of like never aspire? You were like, nah, that's not me, but I want to do comedy and I want to have my own version of the presence like that.
I tried to be many different types of comedians when I started out, but then it wasn't until I got to the 12th year of my comedy did I realize that. Just melt and be whatever comes out. So I just relaxed. And there were moments where I would come off stage and people would say, oh, you sound really ethnic. Or I'd get telephone calls at the studio going, you sound really woggy. Do you look as woggy as you sound? And I would try and change my voice and all that and not be so woggy. But then I got to the stage where I'm like, oh, fuck it. I am a wog. I do sound like a wog. I don't think I do wog comedy, so I'm just going to just do what I do. And I'm like, actually, you know, I like to talk about physics sometimes, but then I like to talk about mushrooms, so I'm just going to do it. Fuck it. Because I've come too far. When you've come too far, you sort of don't care what – you don't have to pander anymore. You've come too far to A, give up, and B, concentrate on fitting into a certain mold for a certain audience.
Right, so you're saying just like the amount of time you've sunk in, you're not gonna stop now, but you're also you're gonna stop trying to
pander
to
a certain demographic. For example, when I was a younger comedian, I got my break on Nova FM, and around that time, I was constantly aware of who was in the crowd to craft material to get onto Channel 10 and so forth. But now I wouldn't do that. I would just do what's on my mind that I want to do.
Yeah,
I'm not going to facilitate a certain crowd. And a lot of times to do that, I started sitting on a stool.
Okay.
Because that was a physicalization of me performing for myself and not standing for them. So that reminded me, okay, I'm doing this for me now.
Right.
What Well, yeah, because there was a while where, you know, you got to develop material and you're dying and just to get to the jokes, they say. And but anyway.
Well, I think that's part of the craft is learning that even then to then throw it away.
Yes.
Sort of.
Yeah.
It's interesting to say that because I guess for some background for people listening, you are ridiculously, I reckon you are top notch as a comedian, actually. Like you're one of the better, like as in, you obviously you've done it now for how many years now, is it?
19 years today.
Today?
Today.
Oh, I feel special. Yeah.
18th of July, 2002 at the Corner Hotel in Richmond with Wayne Deacon going, yeah, come down, just don't fucking die, mate.
That's amazing. Well, congratulations. Thanks, 19 man. Years. Yeah. Well, look, you seem like someone who's like, that's the kind of experience that you bring to the stage, I think. I mean, I saw you, what, two weeks ago? When it was probably longer than that. At that, what's the gig upstairs?
King's Outdoor,
yeah. Yeah, and that was, you fucking destroyed.
That was a good gig. That was
fun. That was wild. I haven't seen an audience. Whew, that was something. You've absolutely destroyed. Like, they lifted the roof. That was amazing.
Thank you.
I do think you've, and also it's funny you're saying that because you're doing your own thing, because I reckon, and this might be, I don't even know if you're going to like this, but I feel like what's interesting about you is you kind of do the cheesy stuff, I guess, like if you want to call it cheesy, some of your material, but like then you go off into a really interesting and weird direction really often. Like it starts off almost like a classic comedy premise a lot of the time, but then you take it in an interesting different way, which I really like. So
yeah,
it's funny you're saying that.
Yeah, thank you. I often feel like that's the process, especially doing a lot of mainstream audiences. It has to sound relatable in the beginning, and when I get their trust, I can then take a left and go off on a tangent into an area that if I began like that, they would be like, what's he doing? This is weird.
Right, so it's a proper conscious choice when you're structuring the stuff.
Yeah. Get them on side first, make it relatable, get them in, and then go off. Like, yeah, get them to, like, talk about airlines and then go off.
Yeah.
And then get into the mushrooms.
Because that's the other one. You seem to like, and then you'll do it again with a new bit. You'll be like almost, now it's something you relate, and then now we're going to go weird with it again.
Yeah.
Right.
I grew up with I cut my teeth in mainstream crowds, very much so, especially in England. Lots of stag parties, lots of hen do's, lots of comedy clubs that are just mainstream gigs. I wasn't doing the alternative circuit in London pretty much at all. I did the black circuit. I did a few tours of the black circuit.
What's the black circuit?
It's black audiences.
Really?
Yeah, mainly black audiences only, predominantly black crowds, like 90%. They don't like whimsy. They don't like pandering. They just like direct stuff, like set up and punch, no fucking about.
All right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. It's interesting.
How'd you fall into that?
I just did a few good gigs in London. A couple of black comics saw me and they go, hey, you'd be really good for the black scene. Come down to Stratford on a Monday night and do 10. And I did 10 in Stratford, which is East London. And that went well. And then, sure enough, I did another one. And
all right.
Yeah, and then I started to work it out. I'm like, oh, wow, this is very set up and punch.
Mm.
As opposed to other gigs where you can take your time and be more whimsy or artistic. And
So it's a different – it's a good muscle to build. Or
yeah, absolutely. Well, that's what England taught me. It built me – I gained versatility. That's what it didn't make me funnier. I just think I learnt to be versatile because you would do a Bucks party on a Saturday night and then a Silver Fox cricket club on a Sunday night and then a black crowd on a Monday night. So you got three different ways to sell your material.
Mm.
You can be direct, more direct with the black crowd, and then on the Silver Foxes, you can't just go straight into the swearing and you got to serve it creatively.
That's good. Yeah, that's a good muscle. And why did you come back?
I came back. I was there for 10 years and I came back because I've got a strong bond with family. I'm just a good Greek boy, I think. I missed my family. I had a fiance at the time who was from Melbourne and she was like desperate to come back. And I just felt it was the right time to come back.
Yep.
It was a time where I just missed so much. I missed backyards. I missed blue sky. I missed barbecues. England is fantastic. It's got so many beautiful things going for it, but it doesn't have those three things that I mentioned.
Yeah.
Much of, anyway.
Yeah, so you came, because what, you got a, so your Greek background, both sides?
Yeah, yeah.
So you speak Greek?
Yeah.
Any brothers, sisters?
One brother.
Okay.
Older, about 7 years older.
All right.
Yeah.
And you missed him as well?
Yeah, I did. I had to think about that. But yeah, I missed the whole, and I missed Melbourne, and I missed Australia. You know, just little things. It's amazing how, you'd wake up at 4 a.m. just to watch a footy game.
You know, oh really?
You'd go out of your way to get a jar of Vegemite because it's been sold in West London near Shepherd's Bush. So you'd go out there and get a jar of Vegemite. It's amazing. You do realize that. Yeah, and that was interesting. At the time, I was like, I kind of don't fit into Australia, but it wasn't until I left Australia for 10 years that I realized, yeah, I am an Aussie. I really am Australian. You know, yeah, I've got Greek blood coursing through my veins, and I'll always be predominantly Greek. I just will.
Yeah.
But I was born here.
Yeah, no one's hearing your accent and thinking you're a proper true blue.
No. But what is a real Australian?
Exactly.
You know? You have to go back 50,000 years.
Yeah, yeah. So... yeah, because actually, I got to ask this, even though we'll go back to the book in just a second, because you mentioned the Woggy thing, and that's how you're saying you didn't feel the Australianness until you went overseas, which I totally understand as well, because sometimes you don't feel it. But you were like a product of a time before, like 10 years before me. So you're like, you'd have really felt the Wogginess stuff.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I was a little bit too... I just missed what happened in Brunswick with the Lebanese Tigers, but they were a gang that was formed to protect all the Wogs that were getting bashed by Aussies in the 70s that were coming into Brunswick.
Wow.
I missed that. But I heard all the stories, you know, that Wogs would have their fish and chip shops firebombed by Aussies telling them to get the fuck out. This is in the late 60s and early 70s. So, yeah, it's...
Jesus. I didn't realize it was that extreme.
Yeah, it was. It was very extreme. They didn't want us. I mean, fuck, white Australia policy. Remember that? Mm. 1967, white Australia policy, except for broom, because they needed Wogs to get the fucking pearls out of the water, because only Wogs were good at it. The Japs and the Italians were brilliant at it. So they go, white Australia for everyone except broom, because we need the pearl industry. So...
all right, so yeah, so you were growing up with like, it's funny because my parents, but they're stubborn old Greeks. They don't talk about anything from the past. Their life doesn't exist. They never tell me anything about them growing
your
up.
Your parents migrated here, right?
Yeah, yeah. They were both older.
Oh, older? My mum came here when she was 19.
Oh, yes, same.
Same, okay, yeah.
Yeah, exactly the same. My mum was 19, my dad was 25.
Oh, that's cut from the same ilk, man.
Yeah.
They're very similar, yeah.
Yeah, just 10 years apart.
Yeah.
That's why I don't sound like... I've got a pretentious sounding voice.
Yeah, so to go back to your original point, it wasn't until I left Australia that I realized, oh, I am an Aussie.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah, because that's when you're like, because you sound like a wog here. Mm. But overseas, you sound like an Aussie.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's a very interesting experience doing a gig in England, having Poms coming up to me straight after talking about the test cricket.
Yeah.
And I couldn't give two fucks about cricket. But yeah, that would just engage me. But once I had an Aussie come up to me and he goes, oh, you're not really Aussie, are you? Oh, the accent. I'm like, yeah, I'm a wog. You got me. The nerve of it.
I know.
But he was from Brisbane, so they're kind of a few decades behind the rest of us.
They'd still be saying that now.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I know. I do know that feeling. Yeah. It's weird. So you actually tried to like Aussie up your voice for a while?
I was very self-conscious when I started stand-up. I didn't want to be another Greek comedian doing Giannopoulos jokes. So I cut my name and became Katz instead of Katsoulis. Mm. And I focused on trying to change my voice so I wouldn't sound so woggy. And that, of course, starts to infringe upon your freedom or degrees of freedom on stage. And it affects your creativity. And before I know it, it affects your mannerisms. You don't want to appear too woggy or dress too woggy. But yeah, that's, I don't know. I had to go through that experience. And now I'm like, I don't give a fuck.
Well, it's funny because like a part of me almost thinks to do the counter to that, though, it's like you could almost call it an character for the stage. So it doesn't necessarily have to limit you if you're like, I'm going to put on this character, which is like a bit more, I don't know, Aussie or something. Okay, in that sense, I don't know.
Yeah, it could work, but I just found it was just affecting me on stage overall.
Mm. And it's funny you're saying like this about the accent though as well, because one thing I think I feel, and to go back to the book we're talking about now with the physics, like it's a very it's a very complex sort of book, but even any topic like that I found with comedy, the more, let's say, working class you sound, the less pretentious you sound, the more you can get away with actually talking about stuff like this. So I feel like your accent in that sense is actually not, it's actually a benefit because people, you don't sound as luxury when you talk about stuff like that.
Maybe. Yeah, that could be a reason. But the way I diffused that was I married it to taking mushrooms. So I would take mushrooms and the audience know I take mushrooms. So already the audience have lowered their opinion of me because I take mushrooms, and then I can go ahead and
you really
tell
said
them about
taking mushrooms like 15 times just then, but yeah.
So then I can tell them about physics.
So what, you would always make sure to mention the mushrooms thing first?
I would sell myself short to the crowd that I'm a drug user, and then here's a piece of physics information. So it wouldn't come across lecturing because I've told them this guy's a drug dealer. This guy's a drug user. He's not lecturing us. He's a tripper.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it changes the angle of how I'm coming at him.
This book's on physics. When did you first read it?
I read it back in 2008.
Okay, so that's after uni, you've been doing your life for a while. Is that the first physics stuff that you kind of got into, or you into it before?
It was the first book I was exposed to, yeah.
Physics book.
Yeah.
Not book.
Yes, well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because like you studied law and stuff in university and stuff, so you're not like, you would have been, this information would have been coming at you, but you just didn't have any interest in this side of things at all.
That's correct.
Right, is that because you were like more focused on English stuff when you were younger, or?
I just think it wasn't in my peripheral, I guess, just other interests at the time. Like I was doing stand-up, I just finished uni, so I didn't want to pick up a book for a while or look at other pieces of information. I just wanted to focus on my stand-up. So, yeah. But once I read it, I was like, oh, wow, this is cool.
Okay, that's pretty understated. All right, okay.
Oh, no, look, I absolutely fell in love with it. That was the moment I fell in love with physics. Because this book was had an amazing ability to talk down and just simplify things to the layman. So all of a sudden, I was reading about all these topics, and it was just clicking. It made sense, and it was profound and beautiful.
Right. So did you have any science interest at all in anything before that? Or not?
No,
really?
I didn't. It's bizarre.
Wow. That is, yeah.
And I think it just goes to show how fucked the school system is, really. True.
Well, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to disagree that learning can be more fun than sometimes they manage to do it. I don't know what schooling's like now, probably in schooling. I hope it's probably more fun now with like iPads and stuff. Mm. Maybe it's more entertaining. And also just the general education has gotten more entertaining, I feel like, in the last, you know, ever since YouTube's come along and everyone's teaching everything everywhere. I feel like there's a lot more entertaining ways to teach it. I hope has influenced education in schools. I don't know. But yeah, so that stuff just didn't grab you until you started this. And then you just fell down this rabbit hole.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, for like, even to this day, I'm always like watching YouTube videos of the World Science Festival. They go for about 2 hours and they just talk about the latest findings in physics. But of course, the World Science Festival, dumb it down. It's for laymen. It's not a peer-reviewed literature piece of work that I can't get my head around that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to YouTube and just Google World Science Festival, they have two-hour-long lectures, where it's specifically physicists talking about the latest developments, but dumbed down and watered down for you to fall in love with.
All right. And then again, that's I think there's different layers to some of this stuff, and especially when it comes to physics. And quantum mechanics and stuff like that. The amount I would have to learn to probably get the more detailed stuff, it's like I'm happy just to get kind of dumbed down and get my brain blown at that degree.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can't. You'd have to commit to like at least 10 years of solid study. And even then, like, you know, Richard Feynman was a famous physicist in the 60s that said, if you think you know quantum physics, you don't. And that's what he used to say to his fellow scientists. So if they don't understand it, we've got no chance. But I think that was the mystery that pulled me in as well. Like, what is this? They don't even know what they're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they don't.
They're telling me.
Well,
like,
got,
I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's like stand-up. Well, you never really know. We don't know. We don't know. We're in this pursuit of comedy. I don't know where the next joke's going to be. I don't really know how I do what I do. How do you have that moment? You incubate a joke and then you go about your business and on stage, bang, this punchline drops out of the ether. And you're like, fuck, I just married all these concepts together that I've been working on for the past 3 months and it's distilled into a punchline. And the crowd erupt, and I've just solved it. I've got it.
I see, as in, like, so you do write on stage?
I write all the time, but I vomit it all out in open mic.
Yeah.
And then as I keep vomiting it out over and over again, the process becomes cleaner, more refined, less words are used, and it distills to a punchline. Like, for example, again, mushrooms.
All right, we're going to have to talk about the mushrooms.
That was a piece. That was just an idea. And I just riff at dumpster fire comedy for like 6 months. And God bless Joel for putting up with it.
Mm.
But it was just riffing on mushrooms, why I take them, why I think they're important, blah, blah, blah. And then over time, I kept doing it and the crowds got more frustrated. And so I realized, all right, I've got to remove words. And then eventually I got to the point where I found it on stage, what I was trying to get at.
So it took a while.
Well, yeah.
That seems like a slightly inefficient way to write it, but you got to do it, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, you got to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
You write, but when you write, you're obviously trying to get a punchline, but you don't beat yourself up. So you just write about it and then reread it and put it on a whiteboard and stare at it as you're going about your day. And then you just go, oh, I've got to take this idea up on stage, and you just riff on it.
It sounds like you've got a very structured way of being unstructured, kind of.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah. That's a good way of putting it. And the next day, I'll listen back to the material that I recorded set.
Mm. Every time?
I try to, yeah.
Wow.
80% of the time.
Nice.
But it'll be, you know, doing stuff like washing dishes, playing PlayStation, and then I'll press pause and go, oh, yeah, that's the bit. That's how you fucking do it, and I'll write that down.
Oh, so you won't just sit there and try to listen to it intently. You'll do it while doing something else.
Yeah.
Huh. Again, that's maybe like a good way to have your subconscious doing the work instead of
thinking
about it too much. Huh.
Yeah, because someone said creativity happens when you're unplanning, when you're not planned, when you don't plan for it. So if you like have, okay, at 11 o'clock, I shall be creative. Until 12 o'clock, then I shall go do my shopping. No. So now I've broken that down. I'm like, I'll play PlayStation, I'll do the dishes, and I'll have my set playing in the background.
And is that, did you always do it like that, or that's kind of developed over many, many years?
The last 6 years I've been listening back to my set because I think it's the best way forward for me.
Mm.
And I got spurred on by hearing Bill Burr say he doesn't write punchlines. He just takes ideas up on stage.
Mm.
So I've sort of got a little bit of both happening. I'll write about a topic, but when I write about a topic, I try and make it sound logical and see does it flow properly and then take it up on stage and riff on it.
Mm. Yeah, try to write out. Write so you can know what you're thinking before you even get anywhere, like what's the actual structure of what you're thinking about and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we talk about...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay. Because you're talking about this physics and stuff, and you've mentioned mushrooms as well.
You don't have to go up on that.
Sorry. No, it's interesting because like I have a friend of mine who's very getting into theories of consciousness quite a lot, quite detailed. He's going into a lot of different stuff about that. And he's like physicist approach to consciousness, not hippie approach to consciousness, essentially, because it really seems like, and you could be teaching me this right now, it seems like the concept of consciousness seems like almost a, it is a branch of physics which is interesting, like as in why consciousness exists and why it works like that. And there seems to be a lot of fundamental, like a lot of metaphysic discussions about the nature of consciousness. And so that's something you've heard about and have any thoughts on?
The only thing I've heard about it is Brian Greene, who's the author of Fabric of the Cosmos, he said in a podcast that consciousness is the one, is the biggest mystery that physicists don't know. They haven't got a clue, and they can't prove, and probably will never be able to prove where consciousness resides, if it's in the brain or out of the ether, and our brain is like an antenna picking it up. So
how
he's
could
like,
it be that, though?
They don't know. They need proof. They need to do empirical science, and they can't because they don't know how to even begin a test to test where consciousness is coming from. They just don't know. They reckon it's, he said it's the biggest mystery.
Right, that's so weird to me because isn't just the brain? It's just neurons firing and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's weird. But if a physicist of that caliber is saying that, then obviously there's some.
He said the only beautiful. He said the beautiful thing that I could say about consciousness is that you have atoms, and when they click to a certain critical mass, they can realize that they're atoms.
Mm.
And that's it. Anything else is hearsay or speculation. But all we know is that if you have atoms and you click a certain number together, you will realize that you're just atoms that have been clicked together. That's it.
That's all we got.
That's all we've got.
That isn't not much.
It's a huge fucking mystery, man.
All right. Okay. That's wow. Yeah. That's well, okay. So, but you're not as interested in that side of things because it is quite out there. I think as a branch, it's super interesting.
It's very out there. See, yeah. What I find interesting about physics, especially Fabric of a Cosmos, is that predictions were made, and then the predictions were tested, and the predictions were proved. Like for example, there was a physicist who calculated that, oh my God, there's no such thing as empty space. You can never have empty space. There's no such thing as nothing. And that concept philosophically blew me away. So I had a vested interest. So I read deeper. How can you not have nothing? There's no such thing. And sure enough, he proved that.
Was that because of gravity?
No, he just proved that with mathematics that space-time on a fundamental level has energy, and that energy is particles popping in and out of existence. So he said that if you set up a test, his name was Casimir, and he said if you set up this test where you suck all the air out of a box, a chamber, you will still have energy inside there. And sure enough, you do.
Right.
And that's particles popping in and out of existence. So he proved that you can't have empty space.
So it's just impossible. Kind of empty space.
It's impossible.
So actually, but on that note, actually, so you mentioned the philosophical side of things. So is that something else you've looked into? Philosophy side of stuff? Or is it? I'm wondering how, like.
Not the philosophy, because I think it's. I read a book during lockdown on Aristotle on his ways to live a successful life.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say more.
Well, it was basic. It was like, find a passion. I'm like, yeah, I know, dude. A lot of philosophy is, I know.
Well, you've heard it all. Like, as in, all the good stuff's filtered out through pop culture to be part of everything.
It doesn't blow me away like physics does. Like, physics, like, nothing touches. Wow. There's no such thing as empty space. Well, black holes actually fade out and die. Oh, wow. Time can actually stop. Wow. You know? Einstein standing on a train platform with his mate. In 1897 or 1898, he was 21 years old, and he's chatting to his mate, and he has this moment where he stares at a clock, and it's ticking over from tick to tock. And as a child, he's always been fascinated by light. He would always imagine what it was like to be riding a beam of light, what you would see. He was always an inquisitive mind. And he had this realization, this penny-dropping moment, that if he stared at the clock while he moved away from it at the speed of light, he would never see the tick move to tock, because the light traveling to his eye to show him that tick has gone to tock would never catch up to his eye.
Mm.
So he would see the time as stopped. And it was at that moment he realized, if you travel at the speed of light, time stops.
Mm.
And then he turned to his mate and he said, I've completely solved the problem. I'll see you in a few months. And then he buried his head with basic algebra, which is studied in year 11, and came out with E equals MC squared and all these calculations and formulas that time actually stops, and it's proven to this day.
Yeah.
So that was, and that is what fascinates me.
Okay. So it is a decision. Okay. That's ironic. So the more, it's more materialistic and fascinating in a nuts and bolts kind of way.
Yeah. So I'm interested in, yeah, in this book, they explain where, how concepts came out and how, for example, Schrodinger. Do you know Schrodinger?
The cat guy. The dead cat guy. Dead alive cat guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he had that epiphany during an orgy.
Really?
Yeah. He was struggling with...
That's in the book?
He was struggling with his mathematics. And he was struggling in a bad marriage. So he went up to a ski chalet with a couple of girls. And in the middle of an orgy, had this eureka moment. And got up and scribbled on a piece of paper the wave equation.
What do you mean? What, that's in the book?
Yes.
That story?
Yes.
Is in the Fabric of Cosmos book?
Oh, it might be in part two of Brian's book, The Elegant Universe, because they've married together those two books. But yeah.
So he's writing about it in there.
Yes.
That is hilarious. That sounds like I would have thought that was an old wives' tale, but that...
No, yeah. So that was... That fascinated me as well, because this guy just worked out that... His brain has developed in a classical world that if you can't, this is going to be very difficult for me to say, but he basically had this epiphany that particles can exist in many places at the same time. And it's so counterintuitive. How can you have a tennis ball that stretches out in space-time and exists everywhere until you measure it? But sure enough, he found this calculation, and he realized that a particle, a fundamental element of which makes up you, me, the chair, the table, everything in the universe, when you isolate it on its own, it smears out and becomes everywhere.
Mm.
And he had that during an orgy. And it's
that's wild.
And that's why your computer works and radios work. And-
okay, so this might be asking too much for you and me to chat right here, because it's something which has annoyed me forever. So I understand the idea of the uncertain, that's hiding or whatever, but like
Heisenberg,
but like this is like, so wait, Schrodinger's first, right? And then Heisenberg?
Around the same time.
Right, but they're different things.
Yeah.
So Schrodinger's about like a particle moving through, or a wave, is that what, and then, but it can be lots of different things. Because what I never understood is when they say you measure it and that changes it, is that Schrodinger?
Yeah, Schrodinger.
So does that mean that when you're saying it could be any of these things, and then you measure it and it becomes one of them, right? Are you actually changing reality by looking at it, or is it just you confirm what it is until that point? So, like, you know what I mean? Like, that's what I've never understood about it. When they say, like, the observation changes the thingy, I never fully got that.
Yeah, and that's what leads to the philosophical debate behind quantum mechanics. Does your consciousness affect the experiment, thereby mean are you attached, connected to...
That's what I mean.
And some
is that what it's doing?
Some scientists say yes, because they say that you...
So me looking at it is literally changing reality.
Yes, because some scientists say that you cannot remove yourself from the experiment because you are in the universe with the experiment coexisting. So you can't step outside the universe and do an experiment.
So if I didn't look at it, it would be all of the things at once. It's only once I look at it that it becomes...
Yes. In layman's terms, if you don't look at it, a tennis ball, if it was a particle, would be everywhere in the next room.
Mm-hmm.
It would, and we'd look on a computer now and we would see a wave function that Schrodinger came up with, and the wave would have peaks and troughs. And those peaks and troughs are probabilities. The higher the peak, the higher the probability of the ball appearing in that corner. A low valley would mean that there's a low probability of the ball appearing in the kitchen if we open the door. And when you open the door, the wave collapses into one point, and that's where the ball is when you measure it.
But
It's called the superposition of states. It's existing everywhere. And that's
what have they confirmed that that is the case where once you measure it, is that does change it?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what...
it's magic!
Yeah, well, yeah, it's magic. And that's why I had to read more.
I think I need to take some mushrooms as well now. I don't think I need to take any mushrooms.
No more than twice a year.
Okay, was that the rule?
That's the rule. You don't want to go bananas.
Yeah.
So basically, yeah, that's and that's why quantum computers that they're working on at the moment, a quantum computer uses that concept of the ball being everywhere in the next room by assigning that quantum bit both a zero and a one. It's, you know how computers are binary, zeros and ones? A quantum computer is both a zero and a one at the same time.
This is wild.
And no one knows what that means, but...
Yeah,
but Brian Greene, who's a wonderful author, explained it as such. He said, pretend you have a labyrinth and you tell a computer to find the exit of the labyrinth. A computer will go in and try all these different paths really fast and it'll find the exit and it'll let you know the path out of the labyrinth. A quantum computer will instantly become... every single path at the same time and give you an answer much quicker. That's how good quantum computing can be. Super fast calculations that take a computer 10,000 years.
It uses magic.
Yes, it uses fucking magic.
It uses magic, in other words. So you're telling me here. All right, that's what we've solved magic. We've created it.
Yes.
How could it be all of them at once? Oh, see, I love this because it's like, this is way above my pay grade of understanding of physics, Stephen. Yeah.
Yeah, because on a fundamental level, that particle is existing everywhere at the same time. And then you get other physicists that are like, no. That particle is not existing everywhere at the same time. No. That particle, the wave function, is showing you multiple universes where that one particle is. And that's Hugh Everett's many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics.
Okay.
So that every time you make a decision, the universe splits off with the choice you didn't make in this universe.
Yeah.
Because you are made up of particles, the same particles that exist everywhere at the same time. So because your particles make up you and they have to follow the same rule of quantum physics, there is an infinite version of you out there in the multiverse.
And it's happening all the time with every decision with everyone on the planet constantly.
Yes.
So there's just, it's literally infinite. Yes. Every second it's infinite. Like as in it's 7 billion decisions being made every second basically. And each one of those then making a decision times two, times three, like as in so every second it's...
Yeah, that's right. And then there's other physicists that get worked up and go, they're called the shut up and calculate school.
Mm-hmm.
And they just shut up and calculate. And they don't care what the philosophical implications are of a particle being in many places at the same time. They just take the answer and they use it for their benefit and they create computers, transistors, and all the electronic revolution that we saw in the 1950s and onwards. They've created nothing as precise as quantum mechanics as a scientific theory. And that's what blows me away. They're using magic to create something that is rock solid.
Yeah, that we're using all the time.
All the fucking time.
Yeah. That's plus
everything. It's bizarre.
That's well. Cool. I can't even get you to I think I've got to read this. I am going to get more into. Because philosophy and physics, it's weird how they do kind of cross-contaminate a little bit. So that's why I'm interested. That's why I was wondering if you'd done any philosophy, but
no,
more
haven't.
On that side. Did you think, I guess it's weird, this podcast, this show of mine, it's meant to be about why these things are the things that stick with you more than anything else. So, like, firstly, do you read any much fiction?
Yes.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Okay. But... obviously, none of it was as formative for you as maybe the first time reading something like this because it opened up a whole world to you.
Well, yeah, because I think you've helped me answer the question. Your two words, magic and fiction. This stuff works. It's a fact. But to me, it's magic and it smells of fiction. You're telling me all this. I'm reading all this stuff that's jumping out of a page and it's blowing my fucking mind. Like, you know how I told you about particles popping in and out of existence? Mm-hmm. Do you know about black holes?
Yes.
All right. At the very boundary of a black hole, the very, very boundary of a black hole, this is what Stephen Hawking became famous for in 1974.
I think I know something about black holes, but obviously I don't know anything. But yeah, what you're saying, yeah?
It's layman's terms. It sucks everything in. Yep. Nothing escapes, not even light, right? At the very boundary of an event, a black hole, it's called the event horizon. They go, once you cross that, you're fucked. You're gone. This is what made Stephen Hawking famous. In 1974, he goes, particles are popping in and out of existence all the time. All the time. But they annihilate each other. So right near a black hole, two particles spontaneously come into the universe out of nowhere, just the space-time. But they can't annihilate because one gets sucked into the black hole. The other one, just above, goes off into space. And that's Hawking radiation. That's leaking mass. But the particle that got sucked into the black hole is negative mass. It has a negative weight. So it steals weight from the black hole, shrinking the black hole. And Stephen Hawking answered the mystery, how do black holes evaporate and disappear? So he discovered that through magic, that particles just pop in out of nowhere.
What do you mean?
Because the fabric of the universe on a fundamental level has a vibration, has an energy. It's like a space foam, they call it. It's just teeming with life, with energy.
That's hilarious.
There's no such thing as nothing. There's no such thing as no energy. But it makes sense because the universe is alive. It is registering a pulse. It's alive. Like stars are cooking atoms where... biological entities, and on a fundamental level, the space-time, the fabric of space itself, has to have an energy, a particle, you know, popping in and out of existence. But the difference is they annihilate each other. They give it back to the universe and they disappear. Except for around black holes.
That's right. So what happens to, like, the fact that one particle disappeared and the other one, does that mess up that particle? Is the Hawking radiation a weird kind of particle?
One flies off.
Yeah, so is that one
damaged?
That's got a
positive weight.
Yeah, so is that different? Because that's the only time that's happening, right? Everywhere else in the universe, it's always got positive and negative.
Yeah.
So does that cause anything, the fact that there's only one half of it with Hawking radiation?
No, it doesn't, because the universe, like an accounting balance sheet, restores order by robbing the mass from the black hole.
Okay, right.
So it squares the ledger.
This is so weird.
It's fascinating.
You're not on shrooms. You're telling me all this.
No, if I was on shrooms, I wouldn't be able to be
so eloquent,
articulate about it.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
It's very difficult.
You can understand why people will be like, "Well, this is tripping me out too much."
Yeah, it's very trippy, and that's why I love reading about it, and that's why I can sit there and watch lectures that are aimed at lay people like myself on the World Science Festival website, which it's done for people like us who have no background, just to understand it.
Yeah, no. So that I love that stuff. So I guess, and actually, this is what I was going to ask you, to relate to the learning thing as well. Actually, there's probably two more things I'll ask before we tie it off. One is, yes, I was asking about philosophy, but really, I should go even wider. Do you like learning stuff, or is it specifically physics is the one that you are super interested in? Because, like, for me personally, I'm like, if anything, I've got a big problem of mine is that I'm too all over the place. I just love fun facts about everything. Like, that's what I'm always like with everything. So everything's interesting to me in that sense. Are you kind of like that? Like, were you growing up, like, you'd always be reading about lots of different things? Or is it literally, physics is just like the thing. That's what you've hooked on.
To answer your question, originally you said, do I love learning? Absolutely. In all facets. In relationships, you mean? In stage? On stage? Everything. In all areas, I love learning. Because it's, I think, loving learning is... essentially evolving as a person. So yeah, absolutely.
Growing in that sense. But yeah, so that's why I tried to clarify, because I'm like, that's good as well. And that is do you reckon everyone does that? Or do you reckon there's a lot of people who don't?
I think there's a lot of people that don't, but I couldn't speak for them. But me personally, I love to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
And especially
you love to grow.
I love to grow. That's why we love doing open mics, and you get the extra butterflies because it's a brand new piece of material and you just don't know how it's going to go.
Mm. But it is always fun, that.
Always.
Okay, so that's one side. Specifically, like, rather than the concept of growth, which I do think is healthy and it's great to always have that attitude, I mean more specifically, like, I guess, didactic learning or whatever, which is like literally study. To phrase it different ways, like, biology, is that something like evolution? Mm. Do you read many books about that?
No, but I wanted to ask you about, I don't know much about it, but what is the driving force of evolution? Is it really just random mutations?
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
So it's putting, okay.
Like, as in, it's just...
It's just random mutations. So, because when a tiger drinks out of a river, behind its ears, it's evolved a pattern of eyes. Mm-hmm. So that a croc would think it's being stared at and it's being observed and it should stand down its attack.
Mm.
That's a random mutation, that driving force to say back in time to go, hey, put some eyes on your fucking ears, because then we can have a comfortable drink of water without our fucking cousins and mates getting picked off.
No, it's...
What is that wonderful driving force? To me, it has an awareness, a consciousness that it goes back in time to tell itself... Get some eyes on your ears so we can drink from the water, because too many of us are getting taken by crocs.
No, see, you're doing the classic winner's curse sort of thing, like where you're looking at the end result and thinking that justifies what came before. All that's happening is that there's a bunch of tigers. One of them has ears which look slightly more like eyes. I mean, we're talking about millions of years and a billion examples. So if you've got like a 5% advantage because yours looks slightly like eyes, then you go down to the watering hole and the other ones get eaten and you live. And then you have kids, and then of those kids, some of them have the eyes, some of them don't. And then slowly over millions of years, it filters out everyone who doesn't have it and actually focuses more on the thing that you do have. So it looks more and more like eyes over a long period of time. But all you're doing is cutting off.
So you've taken the magic out of it now.
Yeah, no, there's no magic in evolution. None, in terms of that. There's none. It's literally just one of the things that which I read a while ago, because people talk about, humans have stopped evolving because we don't have any... pressures anymore. Natural selection isn't happening anymore for humans. But that's actually the opposite of what's actually happening. So natural selection is the ultimate stopper of evolution. So natural selection is basically like saying, all your mutations, we're going to cut them all out all the time, apart from like one specific kind. But what's happening with humans now is that all the mutations are running rampant. So humans are evolving right now more than they've ever evolved in history of everything, just because, like, from a health point of view, everyone's living. So all of the mutations, whatever they are, they're piling up on all of us all the time. So that's the thing that people don't understand about like evolution in that sense. We're passing on everything at the moment. We're not stopping ourselves from passing on anything. While natural selection's actual job is to stop everything from passing on apart from what works to survive. So arguably it's slowing down, it's focusing evolution down a certain path by getting rid of all the other types.
So the eye on the tiger is just, it just looks like, it just happens to
look. We killed off
all
the ones that didn't.
It just happened to look like an eye.
When a crocodile was...
But isn't it like very, like, perfect?
Because you're seeing the end result. So what happens was, when the crocodile...
But it could have been a lighter. It could have looked like a lighter, or could have looked like anything.
Yeah, no, and then the crocodile ate that one.
Okay.
So the one that was left was one that looked kind of like eyes. So we're not saying it was the end result. It was literally just, there's the other thing people get confused about because they're seeing the end result. All you need was the tiger that had the most, it could have been nothing, like literally just a tiny bit like eyes. But because of that, on the huge scale we're talking about of millions of years, that tiny little bit meant that it had a slight advantage over the ones around it. So over time, it slowly got selected. And then because it had that, it had kids. And the ones that had it the most, again, if the crocodile is looking at it, the one that looks the most like eyes, it's not going to go for it. It's going to go for the one with the least like eyes. So then over time, it slowly actually just selects for the ones that have more and more looking like eyes. So even if you've got like 10 tigers there and they all have kind of eyes, the one who's got the most eyes is the one least likely to get attacked if the crocodile's picking.
Mm.
Not that it's picking, but it's going for it, whatever. It's always going to go for the one that has like the least looking like eyes. You know what I mean? So all you're doing is cutting them out. You just cut it out constantly. And so you have a mutation and then you select for that mutation. And that's basically it. So that's the confusing part. You're selecting for a certain thing, but also you need the mutation to get it started in the first place.
All right. So seeing as like to go back to this book and going on what you just said, where do you stand on life out there in the universe in terms of I'm thinking you'd have to agree that there must be life out there, because if we can evolve on this rock, surely there's and we'll never be able to see them or catch up with them ever, because they're just the vast distances to traverse. It's impossible. But the number of galaxies alone, surely there must be evolution like this playing out on, in millions of worlds that we could never get to.
Yeah, it's one of the things I always say. I've gotten more accepting of it, I guess. But if there's one thing I kind of regret, just impossibility, there's two things probably. One is that one is that the future exists. We hope. I used to say this back 20 years ago, but like, you're going to die one day and the world's going to keep going. So like, future exists, a future you're not going to see exists. And that's kind of like, that'd be cool to see. And the other one is aliens exist. We're never going to get close to seeing them, but they exist and they're up there. So right now there are like 4-footed gaseous things. We're never going to see them, but they're there. That's magic to me. That's science fiction concept. But we're never going to see them because they're too far away.
I'm just curious to see with evolution what you were saying about. I saw this documentary which blew my mind about how eventually we're all going to be married to technology, like, and we're going to evolve like AI/biological beings. Do you think that's in our destiny?
I don't know. It's impossible to say, right? They say how the. I mean, you'd think so.
So they had this guy. They gave him a pacemaker, and he can control it through Wi-Fi. They gave this guy a Parkinson's chip in his brain, and when he gets the shakes, he can access it on his phone to release a treatment that stops him from shaking. And I'm like, fuck, man, that's
biohacking.
We're merging.
Yeah, cyborg
shit. We're marrying.
Yeah, yeah. That's the future. But I feel like that's all dime a dozen compared to doing any sort of mental.
Or do
changes.
You reckon it's going to be like that CRISPR program, like genetically modified human beings? Because I think China's already – America's pointing the finger at China going, they're fucking doing it now.
Yeah, I reckon they're doing it now.
So if they're doing it, we have to do it.
Yeah.
You can't send your kid to school as an organic with all these kids with Macs in their brain. Fuck it, your kid's got no chance.
Yeah, and then it's like, what are they going to be even thinking of?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a
Brave New World, right?
Yeah, it's cool. And then all of our dumb learning is going to look like nothing compared to whatever they're doing. Genetic engineering, that stuff seems very possible. Whether they'll be able to make it better or whether they'll just be able to select again. So like you're like, I can select for the best versions of the parents. It's like Gattaca and shit.
Yeah.
But the next step is then, can you actually edit it? So it doesn't matter what the parents are, could you actually make them better? And that, I don't know, that seems like a lot. That seems like a really hard, but I don't know. We have jumped around so much, which is cool. I mean, we did Fabric of Cosmos, so we're going to jump around a lot. Let's stop it there. I feel like we could keep chatting all day.
We could, yeah.
Yeah, natures of death and stuff like that. What do you think of death? Do you die?
You definitely die. And I think, I've been pushed here. I think you fade. Either A, into nothingness, or B, I would like to think you come back, but I doubt it.
Like as in it as another person.
Yeah, I think I don't know. Look, let me be frank. I think you just fucking die, and that's it. What do you think? I mean, I just think it doesn't matter because you cease to exist. So
the you as you are now would cease here. You think so? Whatever you become, whether you merge back into the great one that is all of us, or yeah. I don't think you keep being you. Mm. You wake up and you're like, good, I don't have to do a stand-up set tonight. I'm too busy being a ghost and kicking back.
Yeah, but it just, you know, to go, whether you die or whatever happens when you die, I'm not sure, but I do know from everything that I've read about physics that, all right, we die, we cease to exist, but these atoms that make me up will be used again for something else, to make a tree, to make, I don't know, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? But but your consciousness might not go on.
No. I'm gone.
Yeah, you're gone.
But the atoms, who knows?
Well, that got pretty intense at the end there. But anyways. Thanks for being on, man. It's been really fun.
It's been fun.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Cheers. Man. Oh, yeah, sure. Do you want to give a shout out to anything? You got any socials or anything you wanna shows? Blah blah blah.
Yeah, Johnny Katz, KATS, not Z, not from Caulfield, from Brunswick. That's it. Look me up. I'm on Facebook. See my shows.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thanks.
thanks for listening. If you want to help support this show and all the other shows we do here at Sans Pants Radio, then why not subscribe to SansPantsPlus.com? For as little as $5 a month, you could have access to a whole bunch of bonus shows and content. Once again, that's SansPantsPlus.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.